From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I grew up with the news, really interested in my parents, very interested in public affairs. They don't have a lot of formal education, but always really interested in public affairs. And when I was in college, I just got very interested in it, was working at one of my off-campus, one of my many work-study jobs, I'll say that, when I was in college, was working at the Urban League. And I got really interested in, you know, I was working on their newsletter there just as one of their hired hands. And I just got really interested in the fact that a lot of what they were talking about in the office and a lot of what they were talking about in the community was not something that I was seeing a lot of in the papers at that time. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't understand that. So, you know, the arrogance of youth, I said, well, I'll fix that. You know, I'll write an article. I'm going to fix that. And I just got hooked on it. I think I just got hooked on that whole idea of finding stuff out and telling people about it. I think that's just what I like. I like talking to people.
Michelle Martin, weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. Martin is inquisitive about many things. You wonder what it's like to leave everything and everyone you know for the promise of a better life, to run for president, to be a professional athlete, to parent children of a different race. She is fascinated by people who live lives different from her own, and at the same time, she feels connected to all these lives, being a journalist, a woman of color, a wife, and a mother. As the new weekend host of All Things Considered, Martin will rely on her deep reporting and interviewing skills to dig deep into the week's news. Outside the studio, she is hosting Michelle Martin's Going There, an ambitious live event series in collaboration with NPR member stations. Martin came to NPR in 2006 and launched Tell Me More, a one-hour daily NPR news and talk show that aired from 2007 to 2014 and which dipped into thousands of important conversations, taking places in the corridors of power, but also in houses of worship, the barber and beauty shop, at PTA meetings, town halls, and the kitchen table. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, All Things Considered, weekend host Michelle Martin in Black America.
You know, I'm not going to lie to you. I think I made it clear. I was very disappointed when Tell Me More was canceled. It's not a decision that I agreed with or mm-hmm. made or had a vote in or a say in. So, you know, I was clear on that. But over the course of the year, though, I think I've been doing some work that I think a lot of people appreciate. We're still going to continue doing those events, though. You know, we have the series called
Going There.
Right, from NPR Presents, these live events. We did one in Dallas. By the way, that was one of the ones that we did. It was about football mm-hmm. and ethics. And we also went to New Orleans and talked about education. We went to Charlotte, talked about voting rights. We went to Miami and talked
about immigration. Went to my hometown, Detroit.
That's it. That's what's up. And then this coming season, we're going to go to Pittsburgh. And we're going to go to Kansas City. And I don't want to give you the whole slate of. So we're going to continue to do that. And I think, you know, I like hosting a program. I like bringing people. It really goes back to what you asked me earlier about what first attracted me to journalism. I like telling people things that I think they want to know. And I like telling them things that I think they want to know.
Michelle Martin has spent more than 25 years as a journalist, first in print where she spent more than a decade covering local and state politics for the Washington Post and national politics and policy at the Wall Street Journal, where she was White House correspondent. She also has been a regular panelist on the PBS series Washington Week and a contributor to Now with Bill Moyers. In 1992, Martin joined ABC News where her primary assignment was with Nightline, where she served as the correspondent from 1996 to 2006, reporting on such subjects as the congressional budget battles, the U.S. Embassy bombing in Africa, racial profiling, and the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, Martin graduated cum laude from Radcliffe College at Harvard University in 1980 and has done graduate work at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. In 2006, Martin came to NPR to launch Tell Me More, a one-hour daily NPR news and talk show that aired on NPR member stations nationwide from 2007 to 2014. Recently, she has been named the new host of NPR's All Things Considered Weekend Edition.
It was interesting. Well, you know, my alma mater has been in the news of late, so
yes.
We don't need to talk too much about that, but I will just tell you that I was the third class of girls to go to the school, which was formerly all boys. And yes, it was a little different going there from Brooklyn, New York, where my father was a firefighter and my mother worked in a store. So going to kind of one of the oldest and most storied, you know, prep schools in New England was a little different for me. But I survived it, and now I'm here talking to you.
What sparked that initial interest in journalism?
I started out in print, and I guess I just liked finding stuff out and telling people. I mean, I grew up in New York, as you mentioned, and New York is a 3 in 4 newspaper town. And my parents are big newspaper. We're sadly, my dad's deceased, but we're always big newspaper readers. There are always newspapers around the house, and they were always reading newspapers. And so we just grew up with it as something important. In fact, you know, my uncle was he's also sadly deceased, was career Air Force, and my aunt tells a story about her and my uncle coming home from home on home leave from some place where they were stationed. I think they were stationed at the time, and my mother and she were talking in the kitchen, and you know, at that age, you know, kids aren't supposed to interrupt adults, but she tells this funny story about Mike coming in and saying, "Excuse me, can I have the New York Times, please, if you're not going to read it?" And I was like something like 9 or something crazy like that. So I just think I grew up with the news, really interested in my parents, very interested in public affairs. They don't have a lot of formal education, but always really interested in public affairs. And when I was in college, I just got very interested in it, was working at one of my off-campus, one of my many work-study jobs, I'll say that, when I was in college, was working at the Urban League. And I got really interested in, you know, I was working on their newsletter there just as one of their hired hands. And I just got really interested in the fact that a lot of what they were talking about in the office and a lot of what they were talking about in the community was not something that I was seeing a lot of in the papers at that time. And I just didn't understand that. So, you know, the arrogance of youth, I said, well, I'll fix that. You know, I'll write an article. I'm going to fix that. And I just got hooked on it. I think I just got hooked on that whole idea of finding stuff out and telling people about it. I think that's just what I like. I like talking to people.
I understand. Covering the local beat in Washington at the Washington Post, tell us some of the most enjoyable stories that you had a chance to cover.
Well, I covered everything. I mean, I don't know if it's still like that, but the Post at that time really prided itself on, you know, like everything, both really, really local and really, really national, right? Of course. And so, of course, being a little baby reporter, you cover the really, really local. But I really, I remember covering one of the first births of like quintuplets or something. Like, I think it was quintuplets. I think it was a lady had quintuplets, and that was considered such a huge deal at the time that I went, you know, to their house to cover the story. And they showed me how, like, they had built like this special addition onto their house so that they could kind of feed all the kids at once and all this stuff. And I just was floored by this. You know, I thought to myself, how do you do that? How do you take care of 5 babies at once? So that obviously stuck with me for a reason, since I later had twins. And of course, now, you know, having twins myself, if people have 3, I'm amazed. Like, how can you do that? How could you possibly do that? In a way that, of course, when people have a singleton, they're amazed at me. You know, they say, well, how could you possibly do that? You just do. So that was just, for some reason, that stuck with me. All kinds of interesting stories. I remember one of the first big demonstrations by what later became a really significant organization, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, because they were protesting at a live poultry store. And it will probably, those of you who know the Washington, D.C. area will know that the area that this live poultry store was in is now in an extremely kind of what we call rapidly gentrifying, quickly becoming fancy neighborhood that was a couple of blocks from our old NPR office. So you can imagine when, you know, years later, and I'm working at NPR, I was amazed to go by this, what used to be the Arrow Live Poultry store, where this demonstration was this group that nobody had ever heard of before called PETA, picketing this store. And now it's a very posh restaurant.
When you left the Post, you went to the Wall Street Journal. Everyone sees scandal. Anything familiar? You've been a White House correspondent?
Well, all right. I will let you in on a little known fact, which is that the woman that is upon whom scandal is loosely based, I have to say very loosely based, because to my knowledge, you know, no one in her shop has ever killed anyone or caused them to be killed. And I know for a fact, to the degree that I can know anything as a fact, I know she did not have an affair with the president. But the then deputy press secretary at the time was a woman named Judy Smith, and who was the deputy press secretary when I covered the White House. So I know Judy Smith very well. And in fact, some years later, I owe her a great debt of gratitude because she introduced me to the man who is now my husband. So that's a little trivia for you. You can drop that at a cocktail party if you want.
What made you make the transition from print to ABC News in 1992?
was just interested in it. I was just, I think like you, I was just interested in it. And I just wanted to know what it was like being part of a press corps at the White House. You see people in all media. Mm-hmm. You see people working in all forms. You see people from the international media. There were people from the French media and the Japanese media. And you see people every day. And you know, I don't know if you know this, but there's assigned seating, you know, at the White House. And so my seat at as the Wall Street Journal correspondent was directly behind the NBC correspondent. And I used to get a kick out of the fact that when the president was about to come out or some notable was about to come out, they would always have their earpieces in and they would always be fiddling with it. And they would be talking to people as if, you know, nowadays everybody does that. They're all talking to themselves and you have no idea who they're talking to. But back then, this was really unique. And I would see them, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, oh, okay, well, I don't know, I don't know, ask, I don't know. And I think, what are they doing? And they'd say, I'm talking in my ear. Sorry, somebody's talking in my ear. So the truth of the matter is, initially, I just wanted to know what it was like for somebody to be talking in your ear. I just wanted to know. So when I was asked to try out for a position at one of the networks because one of their correspondents had unexpectedly, you know, left and taken another assignment somewhere else, I just wanted to do it for the fun of it. And no one was more shocked than I was when they actually offered me a job. Now, I didn't wind up taking that job, but I just was intrigued. I mean, it's just, I just wanted to know what it was like. And I think that also, you know, the Wall Street Journal is a major national paper, but its primary focus is economics. You know, economics, finance, right. and politics and policy. And I was just interested in covering other things as well. And I just thought it would be fun. And it turns out that it is fun. And I'll just be honest, it suits my personality. I mean, broadcasting is a team sport. And I enjoy working with a group of people. I like that aspect of it.
What was it about NPR when they, I assume they approached you to do Tell Me More?
Say it again, please.
What was it about NPR that got you away from ABC News to do
the
Tell
glamour.
Me More?
Yeah, the glamour and the Lincoln Town Car, which I did not have. By the way, just making sure you knew that, I did not have a Lincoln Town Car to take me around. Okay. But in fact, that's another funny story. My husband was a guest, actually, on Nightline at one point for something that he was involved in. He's a lawyer who's had some significant cases. And I remember being really irritated that day because they sent a car to pick him up, but I still had to drive to work. I'm like, what's up with that? What is up with that? Why is that okay? And he's like, sorry, baby, you know how it is. So there was that. But I can tell you that I was a correspondent at Nightline. I work with some really great figures in the news for whom I have great respect. I mean, the Ted Koppel, you know, first among them. I think he's a great journalist and a fine human being. And a wonderful mentor, to be honest with you. But, you know, after a certain point, John, I'm sure you feel the same way, you'd rather be driving your own Fiat than be a passenger in somebody's Escalade.
Gotcha.
Am I right?
You're
Am
correct.
I right?
You're correct.
So after a certain point, you want to drive. I want the keys myself. I want to drive my own. I'll drive the Fiat rather than be a passenger in your Escalade. And so, you know, when they offered me the opportunity to drive my own car, I was very happy to do that.
How did you come up with the format? That you had the barbershop on Friday, but it seems to me when you conducted the interviews and the program itself, it wasn't like you were in a studio. It may have been like you were in the kitchen and people were dropping by and you were having conversations about different topics of the day.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that very much because that's exactly what I was hoping for. Truthfully, it all came about just that way. When we were putting the program together, you know, I and my team and the people we were working with, we really were just bringing together the things that we wanted to hear. I mean, the easiest way I can explain it is to say that, you know, somebody asked Toni Morrison once why she wrote The Bluest Eye. Mm-hmm. And she said, I wrote the book I wanted to read. Right. So we created the program we wanted to listen to. And, you know, the barbershop was part of it, the beauty shop roundtable. The barbershop roundtable, for those who, you know, aren't aware, was a roundtable of men talking about the issues of the day, mostly, you know, politics, sports, culture. And then in response to, you know, demand from our listeners, we also started the beauty shop, which we talked about that. And we also had a parenting segment, which started out being all moms, but then the guys wanted in as well they should. And so that segment became, so it evolved, you know, over time. But really, we put on the program we wanted to listen to. And I'm glad, and I really thank you for that, because that to me is a great compliment. That's exactly what we were hoping for. We were hoping that it was a program where people didn't think they had to put their jackets on to listen to it.
Right.
That's what we're going for. And frankly, just to tell you about it, that's kind of what we're hoping for with Weekend All Things Considered. I know that, you know, we obviously adhere to the highest standards of journalism. You know, we're not, you know, we are here to tell you what's true and what you need to know. But we also hope that it will have that vibe of, you know, it's the weekend, you know, take your jacket off.
When they came to you to, I assume, offer you the hosting position, one, will you host a program solo or will there be a co-host?
Why are you offering, John? Are you
No, I'm
are
good.
Are you applying?
I'm good.
Are you trying to say you don't think I can handle it? Is that what you're trying to say?
Not at all.
I'm just trying to cover
all the bases.
You know, we'll have contributors surely, but okay. I'll be manning the board by myself. Well, with my TD, of course, with my engineer. I don't get on the air by myself, but our team will be getting on. But no, there won't be a co-host. There'll be contributors. You'll hear other voices than mine.
I wasn't inferring that you weren't capable of the task.
Just wanted to make sure that was clear. I always thought you weren't throwing any shade there.
Not at all.
Okay, because you know I can find my way to Austin if I need to come and speak to you. Like, okay, I'm just making sure.
Word up.
That's right.
So what was the exciting part of you accepting this new challenge?
Well, I think, John, we all agree that when one's employer asks one to do something, the preferred answer is generally yes. I think they generally appreciate it when the people who pay you ask you to do something. Well, over the course of the year, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I think I made it clear. I was very disappointed when Tell Me More was canceled. It's not a decision that I agreed with or made or had a vote in or a say in. So, you know, I was clear on that. But over the course of the year, though, I think I've been doing some work that I think a lot of people appreciate. We're still going to continue doing those events, though. You know, we have the series called
Going There.
Right, from NPR Presents, these live events. We did one in Dallas. By the way, that was one of the ones that we did. It was about football and ethics. And we also went to New Orleans and talked about education. We went to Charlotte, talked about voting rights. We went to Miami and talked
about immigration. Went to my hometown, Detroit.
That's it. That's what's up. And then this coming season, we're going to go to Pittsburgh. I'm going to go to Kansas City. And I don't want to give you the whole slate of so we're going to continue to do that. And I think, you know, I like hosting a program. I like bringing people. It really goes back to what you asked me earlier about what first attracted me to journalism. I like telling people things that I think they want to know. And I like telling them things that I think they want to know. And I really enjoy it. I like everything about it. I like the process. I like the reporting. I like the writing. I like the talking. I like the teamwork. I think I'm pretty good at it, too, a little bit. What do you think?
Just a little bit.
A little bit. It might work out. On Monday, on All Things Considered, we talk with two researchers about how fear may affect how Black men and even boys are treated by law enforcement and potential employers. This morning, we're taking a closer look at how these fears may affect the way Black men feel about themselves and each other. I spoke with Doeen Richards, founder of the parenting blog DaddyDoinWork.com, and with Paul Butler, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former federal prosecutor. And I started by asking Paul Butler about whether he had ever had the experience of being seen as frightening.
All the time. I mean,
even now?
Walking home in my beautiful upper middle class neighborhood in D.C., when the cops start following me, kind of like this cat and mouse thing, they're in their car. You know, every time I move, they move. And we get up to my house and I just stop in the street and say, "What are you guys doing?" And they say, "What are you doing?" I say, "I live here." They said, "Prove it." They made me go to my porch. And then when I got there, I said, "You know what? I don't have to prove nothing." I knew this because I'm a law professor. And they said, "We're not leaving until you go in the house because we think you're a burglar." I said, "You're doing this because I'm Black." They said, "No, we're not. We're Black too." And that was true. These were African-American officers. Even they were racially profiling me, another Black man.
This is very interesting, and I'm going to raise another issue about that. But first, I want to hear from Doeen Richards. You're the father of two young daughters, and you were telling us that your daughters notice that people seem to be afraid of you. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in my personal story is when I was out with my oldest daughter, who's four, we were in a shopping mall in a garage in Los Angeles, and we're walking, and there was a lady who was with her husband, and I could tell that they just got really nervous around me. Then when we went to an ATM, I had to get some money, and there's another couple. I heard the woman say, "Hurry up, let's go, let's go," like I was going to rob them. And my daughter was like, what happened, Daddy? What's that all about? And do I have to go into this conversation of, yeah, well, honey, sometimes people look at the color of my skin and they think that I'm a threat to them.
You know, to that end, we put out a call on social media asking people either whether they either felt fear of black men or whether they were black men themselves who saw other people reacting to them. And we heard from a number of people. One of them was a man named William Underwood of Chicago, Illinois. He talked about how often he feels like he needs to prove that he's not dangerous. This is what he told us.
Every day I get tired of it. It's very difficult because you just are constantly thinking about what you have to do next, how you move and how you perceive yourself not to be dangerous. And when you're in public areas, particularly like transportation, I don't pull my phone out really quickly because people think it's a gun or something. And I wish that wasn't the case. I wish people would see me as the person that I am. People don't see that. And that's heartbreaking sometimes.
I hear a lot of emotion there, Dwayne.
Wow. Yeah, and I completely hear what he says, and every day for me as well, you know, sometimes if I'm walking down a street or something, I'm whistling Frozen songs just to prove that, like, hey, I have kids, I'm not a threat to you, I just want to go home to my family. So often people just view this as like, oh gosh, or just whining, or they're just making excuses or pulling out some mythical race card that doesn't exist. This is a real thing. So.
Well, put to that end, though, Paul, I mean, let me play another clip from a man named Leo Cunningham. He's an ordained minister in Columbus, Ohio. We actually heard from him in an earlier conversation, All Things Considered. But let's just hear something that he had to say about this.
I have been in situations where I'll maybe assess another black man. It's a question of his age, how is he dressed, the environment that we're in. And sometimes it's as simple as the proverbial head nod, to make sure that we see each other, we respect each other, and neither one of us is not only a threat to each other, but we agree we're on kind of the same common journey as black men in America.
Well, I don't know. What about that, Paul? I mean, some people would hear that and say, okay, you've internalized this, but then other people would say, that's just common sense. I mean, I think a lot of people might remember Reverend Jesse Jackson, where he talked about how it hurts him to, if it's a young black kid walking behind him, and to be leery about that.
Michelle, I want to get your viewpoint. There's been a lot of conversation, particularly in the African-American community, about the Black Lives Matter movement. And there seemed to be some disagreement in as that the Black Lives Matter movement is anti-law enforcement. Your take on this?
Well, I can understand why people think that. I think I have a very, I don't want to say unique perspective on it, but perhaps a little unique because I come from a law enforcement family. Mm-hmm. I mean, I come from a law enforcement family. Like five members of my family have been in law enforcement at some point. I'm talking about my immediate family, including my father, two of my uncles, my aunt, two of my cousins, and my grandfather were all involved in law enforcement. Okay. In New York. And this is not a secret because obviously if I ever get called for jury duty, this comes out. So I'm not telling you anything that anybody
right.
doesn't know. And my husband is a former prosecutor. On the other hand, we are all African American. And so that experience of, you know, feeling as though you're immediately considered sort of dangerous mm-hmm. is one that we all know. In fact, I have had conversations with relatives. I'm not going to identify them because they're still on the job of say, traveling and being sort of viewed as suspicious just de facto and having to say to people, hey, you know, I'm on the job too. Mm-hmm. So we've had those conversations. I feel that I have some insight into just on a personal level mm-hmm. about the various aspects of this question. It is a tension point in our society. I mean, you don't need to take my word for it. If you look at every survey of public opinion where enough people of different races are surveyed in order to differentiate accurately, you will see that attitudes toward law enforcement and attitudes about law enforcement are one of the areas in which African Americans and people from other backgrounds most diverge. That is just a fact. So talking about it, in my view, is not, you're not picking at sores for the sake of it. You're right. This is just a fact. And I think that we have to figure out how to cover this. It's an important story, and we just have to cover it because it just is a fact. And I'm just of the opinion that pretending it is not so does not change it. That is also one of the events that we did in Los Angeles. We did an event around the whole question of law enforcement, and I just think that it is one of those issues that when people sometimes advocate for themselves, they are often seen to be against someone else. And that is unfortunate. But I have interviewed so many people on all sides of this question, and I feel that really the only way to bridge a divide is for those conversations to continue, for people not just to talk about each other, but for people to talk to each other. And if we in the media can be a vehicle for that happening, then that is what I think we should do.
Final question, Ms. Martin. As a woman of color, a wife, and a mother, what are some of your hot button issues that you have, either on the job or at home?
Now, you really aren't going to ask. I will be discussing that at home with the person that I need to discuss that with,
okay,
John. And if I need your assistance in backing me up on that, I will let you know. Although I will mention that I do hope that certain people have called the homeowners insurance to find out what they're going to do about who knocked down our fence. That's all I'll say. But other than that, my hot button issues, what are they? You know, there's a saying that there's a billboard on one of the churches near my house that I pass on the way to work. And it says that he who angers you controls you.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to work very hard to not let that which angers me controls me and to be led by other impulses, if I can put it that way. So I'm going to leave it at that. I'm going to try to be led by my best impulses, not by the people who want to push my buttons. How about that?
All right. Can you give us the idea of your first program tomorrow?
I can.
Would you like me to? Yes, I would.
Okay. All right. Our first program tomorrow, we're obviously still working on the news of the day. We come on the air at 5 o'clock Eastern Time, 4 o'clock Central Time. And so we're obviously making sure that whatever we bring you is the most up-to-date information available. Mm-hmm. But from right now, I think that the lead is whatever we need to know, whatever we feel we can do to add value on the whole question of this, you know, this terrible shooting in Oregon. I think we're going to talk about the state of play. You know, the president made this very impassioned plea for another legislative response to this, what he called, you know, common sense gun safety measure. So we're going to talk about the state of play in that. And I also hope that we will hear from people with a different perspective about this. And perhaps he called upon gun owners to, what he said, step up to the plate and, you know, take responsibility for, you know, improving this area. And we're looking for somebody who can articulate that point of view. And I think we're going to do that. And I will tell you, if you're familiar with the Barbershop Roundtable, we are going to bring it back. We are going to bring it back.
Michelle Martin, weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.